This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Joel Weber is editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us on the Access line from Brooklyn. Hey, Joel, here we are. This is the moment that we've certainly all been waiting for. We're on the campus of Stanford University to really talk about the annual report, the annual ranking that you guys do at Bloomberg Business Week. So take us into really what this is a culmination of.
Well, I'm really jealous that you're on the West Coast at
you
Stanford.
Should be, Joel.
It's sunny.
Yeah, there is this little bittersweet thing though. I'm an Oregon Duck graduate. Stanford really clobbered us on the football field a couple weeks ago. I'm still not over it. So maybe me not being there is part of that. But no, not really. Stanford is a repeat at the top of our ranking. So glad that you guys could be out there and talk to some students and alumni. Tim, to your point, how did we get here? Well, every year we talk to different constituents, students, alumni, recruiters, and we've always focused around four indexes. And it's, you know, worth mentioning here, Business Week's Business School ranking has been going, this is something we've done for 30 plus years. But the methodology is amazing, and it really hinges on listening to those stakeholders and then coming up with a really comprehensive way of ranking them. And the four tent poles of that are compensation, learning, networking, and entrepreneurship. And then the new addition for this year is diversity. And that's something that we'd never been able to figure out how to do. And then we cracked it and felt like the time couldn't be more perfect to bring that into the ranking.
Yeah. You know, and what's fascinating, Joel, in some of the conversations that we're having, we're going to talk with the dean of the Graduate School of Business here at Stanford in just a moment, is that that's playing an important role, whether it's in what's being taught in the classroom. They're, you know, thinking about leadership at a time of, you know, coming off the pandemic. We're not over it yet. We're thinking about diversity and inclusion, George Floyd. Like, there's so many things that are being brought into the classroom.
That's right. As future business leaders, you know, it has to be part of the discussion in the same way that it has been part of the social discussion here in America, mm-hmm. and also abroad, right? So, and that's also worth mentioning,
right,
that, you know, the ranking takes into account international schools. So the things that really, you know, Stanford stood out for in the ranking and why they ended up being number one: compensation, networking, and entrepreneurship. And those three categories being, you know, three of the five things. When you score so high on each of those things, it's going to put you at the top. And you know, you just can't. Stanford is almost synonymous with what has become of the business world, right? So it is clearly
above
and beyond. And I can't wait to hear what you all learn from talking with the dean and everybody else out there.
Joel, we're gonna have some fun, okay? And we're gonna make sure that you come with us next year, okay?
Okay, I look forward to it.
All right. Okay, all right. Thanks so much. Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week, joining us from Brooklyn.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We are live at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and we're lucky to have with us the dean of the school. He's John Levin, and he's also a Stanford alum, safe to say. First of all, congratulations on being number one, according to the Bloomberg Business Week rankings. Not the first time. Our radio audience, our TV audience, our YouTube audience are all listening now. What does that mean for you guys when that ranking comes in?
Great. Well, first of all, thank you, Carol and Tim, and welcome back to the GSB. It's great to have you here. And it's just a wonderful thing for the school. I think it mostly because it just puts a spotlight on what we do here. And I've been at the GSB now for 5 years. And I think if there's one thing that I have learned in that 5 years, it's about the value that gets created in a place like this, where we have these academic faculty who are doing great scholarship, and that was exemplified this week when one of our faculty members, Hito Imbens, won the Nobel Prize in Economics.
Right.
And these amazing business leaders who come in and meet with our students, and the activity that just takes place on this campus. And having you here is a great way for you to see all of that and what goes on here at the GSB.
I'm looking around campus right now, and
there's
I'm thinking
people.
To myself, are we in the midst of a global pandemic? I don't actually know. I mean, it seems like things are pretty much back to normal here. So give us an update about how the pandemic has affected academics and really how you're pushing through it in 2021.
Yeah, so it's wonderful to have our students back on campus. And I think one thing that we have learned from the pandemic, we've learned a lot about technology and opportunities to deliver education to technology, but we've also learned about the incredible value of a residential education, residential MBA education, and how much of the value that gets created here, actually for research and scholarship, faculty interacting, and for education, just comes from having people together in a physical environment and the serendipitous interactions that take place on the campus.
You know, Dean Levin, we had kind of a real world life experience of learning how a vaccine was made in the last year and a half. So many different real world experiments. We lived through them. I do wonder about the experiment of hybrid education or virtual education. I think some thought, wow, we can do it. Others said, no way. I don't know, we've lived through it, you lived through it, does it work?
I think we learned a huge amount during COVID. We moved the school online over a weekend, and the faculty and our staff and the students, people dove into virtual education and doing it remotely on Zoom, and I think it went way better than anyone had any right to expect. I'm incredibly proud of the way the school
was
able to do it.
But not great still.
But what you lose is the unplanned encounters, the unexpected meetings, the chance things. Just to give you an example, one of the stories that Hito Imbens, our Nobel Prize winner, told was that he came up with the ideas that won him the Nobel Prize talking to one of his colleagues in a laundromat. And you don't have that on Zoom. And what we're creating here in this physical environment is lots of laundromat meetings. Lots of meetings where students bump into other students and they come up with an idea for a career or a company, or maybe they bump into someone from the School of Engineering, or a faculty member runs into another faculty member, a student, and that's where the next Nobel Prize comes from. And it's so good to have everyone back on campus so we can have more laundromats.
Does it become a tougher sell at any point in the near future, at any point during your tenure, in terms of convincing people that the education is worth the cost? After all, more than $1.6 trillion in outstanding student loan debt for Americans.
I think this is a really transformative and important time for business generally. And if you think about the forces that are shaping business today, very rapid advances in technology, major changes in global economics, the concern about social equity, about climate change, These are big challenges for business and big challenges for educating business leaders. And where could you better learn and get prepared to tackle those big challenges in the world and in business than by coming to a place like Stanford, where you will get to meet other people and get exposed to the technology that's going to change the world and to the ideas, the social science ideas, and be with a set of peers who can help you assimilate them and prepare you for your career. I'm not worried at all about the value of MBA programs.
Hey, one of the value of coming to a school like Stanford is diversity of thought and diversity of people from different backgrounds, from all around the world, minorities, you know, obviously men, women, people just of all kinds of genders. What I'm curious is, there was a diversity component to the rankings this time. Most schools didn't do well. And even top schools like yourself, you know, had we're ranked a little bit lower when it comes to diversity rankings. So how do you square that? And how do you teach a population of students that are diverse, and yet they're going to go out in the work world, and they're going to be met with employers who aren't very diverse? How do you deal with that?
Look, education is fundamentally about encountering difference. Different people, different ideas, different cultures.
Right.
And the way that you create a great educational experience, and I think the way many companies are now trying to create a great workplace and productive environment, is to bring in a broader range of people, and then to create an environment where everyone can be at their best, and you get the most out of different people's perspectives.
But they're not doing it very fast, or fast enough.
So I think when I think about what we're doing here, first of all, we're thinking about that aspect of diversity, diversity of ideas and diversity of people, across many different dimensions, across who we have here, across the way we teach, across our curriculum, across how we hire faculty. I just came from a meeting this morning with a group of students in a program we have for students in college to help them think about the prospect of going to PhD programs and eventually becoming business school faculty. We've been running this program for a number of years, and now we see graduates of it who are in PhD programs coming back to talk to the other ones. So it's a long-term investment to add more diversity to institutions like Stanford, but we also have to approach it with urgency, and that's the way we're going at it.
We have to leave it there. And it's so great to spend some time with you and see like the work that you guys are doing. And congratulations again.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. We really appreciate it. Dean John Levin, of course, he is Dean of the Stanford Graduate School of Business. And we're going to continue our coverage here in California. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Lots of conversations with folks here at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, and that includes one professor, Ken Schatz.
Yeah, professor of political economy here at Stanford. We spoke to him earlier in the day. In this excerpt, the professor speaks ethics in business. Check it out.
You know, when you think about those high-profile issues in society recently, we see that this is part of responsible leadership. So at the GSB, we're really trying to train leaders of companies and other organizations, but really the people who are at the top, who are the most successful and having the most impact in the world, this is a core part of what it is to be a responsible leader nowadays, is grappling with these issues. And that's not just in the sense of like, something gets in the public eye and you get asked questions about it by the media or your employees or activist groups or things like that. It's also because companies foundationally have all sorts of impacts in the world and major, major impacts. And a responsible leader is someone who thinks about those impacts. And there's a variety of different ways that they could sort out those decisions, but they need to be aware of those impacts.
But how does that square with a company's bottom line? Here we are in the midst of earnings season. We care about the top line growth. We care about earnings. We care about projections. There are no questions from analysts on investor calls about ethics.
I think there are questions about things that are related to ethics, like what are you doing about sustainability or some commitments you've made about this, that, or the other thing. But yeah, there aren't questions about like ethics per se. And I should say I like your question because it doesn't presume that everything is a win-win-win. I think there's a tendency for a lot of people to talk as if there are no trade-offs. And especially to say, well, in the long run, there are no trade-offs. Because if you do something that is problematic in some way, it's going to harm your reputation in the long run. And I think a lot of the time, the short-run benefits can exceed, you know, the long-run reputational harm. So the short-run financial benefits for a company. And I think the question is, if a company claims it has values and wants to live by those values, it actually needs to do it. So, you know, in the book that Neil Malhotra and I recently wrote, we have this framework we call the five P's, which is you first got to set your priorities. Saying we care about the world isn't enough, right? There's all sorts of things in the world you can care about. Set the priorities, measure those priorities, have performance metrics, then use incentives, pay and promotions, and put people in positions of power who are aligned with those things. And that's just like many other things that companies do. If a company says we care about these things, they've got to do it deeply in the organization.
Well, help us out with, right, I think about how much we talk about all the companies that are over in China. And there's lots of questions, obviously, in terms of human rights issues, and kind of pick your area, the impact on the climate. What do we make of a company like Nike that stays there sells there, works there, LinkedIn, who pulls out? Mm-hmm. Is LinkedIn a more ethical company because they do that?
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing there is that there's both normative and, by which I mean values-based questions there, and there's also implicitly positive or social scientific questions. So companies often say, if we stay in, it'll have the following positive consequences.
Right.
Or if we get out, it'll have the following effects. Those are questions for social science, right? And so you need, you know, scholars to study those things. It's not enough, you don't want to.
Because we don't know yet?
Well, it's hard to tell, right?
Okay.
Because to really know at an empirical level, right, you need to run a randomized control trial, right? You do what you do with COVID vaccines. You see, does it work, does it not work? Turns out they work, it's awesome. You want to do that same thing as a scientist, as a social scientist.
Right.
We can't do that typically, so you need, and actually this is related to what my colleague Hito Imbens just won the Nobel Prize for, you need ways of thinking about, you know, how you get sources of variation that are sort of quasi-random and how to interpret causal effects from those things. But it's also questions of values. You can have all the social science linked up, and then you can have deep values-based disagreements about, is your responsibility to investors, to the people of China, to people in the United States?
Yes, yes, and yes, perhaps, right?
Yeah, and it's hard to weigh those things.
Right.
And this is the challenge. And, you know, back when Milton Friedman was the way that everyone was talking about everything, you know, it's easy to say long-run shareholder value.
Right, that's the only social responsibility that matters.
But then if you say we have these other things that matter, then you got to start weighing those.
Yeah.
And honestly, I haven't seen a really clear articulation from the Business Roundtable or anyone else about how one ultimately should do that. And the reason is, because different people have different deeply held values. Mm-hmm. So it's not like people are bad people, that's why they're not coming to that clear articulation. It's that there's deep disagreement.
That was our interview with Ken Schott, Stanford Professor of Political Economy. Check out more of that interview on the Bloomberg Terminal and, of course, at Bloomberg.com/QuickTake.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We've got a really special guest. We're talking about Carlos Brito. He was longtime CEO of AB InBev. He's class of 1989 at Stanford, and he joins us via Zoom. Brito, it's so nice to have you here with us. How are you?
Very good. How's it going? How's out there in California?
It's really nice out in here
sunny.
In California.
It's a really sunny day.
Hey, listen, talk to us about, first of all, you know, your tenure as CEO at AB InBev, long time. You really transformed that company into the largest beer maker in the world. A lot of acquisitions, big acquisitions. Tell us about the beer industry right now. Where do you think it goes from here? What are some of the challenges that are facing the industry right now, really key challenges?
Sure, I mean, we built AB InBev in a global brewer it is today. I was very lucky to be part of a very talented team. We did it all together. And we started in one country in Latin America, one country in Europe, and we became a global company with presence in all continents. And in terms of trends, I mean, you know, the beer industry continues to be very healthy. I mean, consumers continue to premiumize, to trade up, to pay more for beer. That's very good. Consumers continue to look for opportunities to engage with beer, and they had to go to their homes when bars and pubs were closed, but they were very connected to our brands. Big brands did very well during COVID. Global brands also did very well, continued to grow. So the beer industry went from a local business to more of a global brand type business. Innovation continues to play a big role in beer. And, you know, being a natural product that's made of natural ingredients through a natural process, which is fermentation, the same way you use for wine or make bread. It has a clean label, which consumers favor a lot these days. And we offer a portfolio that goes from, you know, full beer all the way to 0.0 beer. So the whole thing about moderation. And so these are some of the trends we see. Great industry to be in. In terms of challenges to your question, I think like every business you read in the paper every day, it's about supply chain being very, you know, tough, inflation, it creeping up, and also some, still for beer, some countries that where travel is yet restricted. And our business has a lot to do with entertainment, with consumers moving, people having fun, and this is still restricted in many parts of the world.
If you were still at the helm of the company, Brito, how would you navigate these supply chain challenges right now? What would you be doing to ensure that you can keep costs down when so many costs of raw materials like aluminum are continuing to move higher?
Yeah, I mean, we've always been a very efficient brewer. We are a high quality brewer with very high efficiency, ABI I'm talking about. And commodities, of course, there's not much you can do. ABI has a hedging program, a 12-month hedging program, so that is time to react, to plan, and everything else, we try to be as efficient as we can, so we can also have less impact on the environment. So we try to use water the best way we can, farming products the most efficient way we can, so we can have high quality with the least impact on the world that surrounds us.
You know, you're talking about the future. What are the trends that you think are coming this way? Is it more non-alcoholic? I know Tim likes that. Hard seltzers, fad, how do you see it? You know, does that stay around? Consumer taste can change pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, there are many trends that were there before COVID, and COVID made some of them escalate or progress even faster. But some of the trends were clear. During COVID, people rediscovered the home and way to entertain at home. Consumers continue to be, you know, trading up, as I was saying before. Because they continue to consume more beverages with meals, which for beer is something new. For soft drinks has always been the case, but for beer, because of the home as a hub, became more of the case. Consumers continue to look for alternatives in terms of health and wellness, and that's where seltzer plays a role. Less carbs, less calories, less bloating. And clean labels remains a big priority, and convenience. Consumers and retailers became very usual to interact with companies via apps and had things delivered to them. And that during COVID, as we all know, was the name of the game. And B2B and B2C, the rate of adoption went up big time during last year, 2020.
But is hard seltzer one of those trends that consumers, one of those healthier trends that consumers will continue to move toward, especially consumers here in the United States? And I got to ask, because just last month, Boston Beer withdrew its guidance over softness in the hard seltzer market. So again, are you seeing hard seltzer as a fad and Americans are going to move past it?
Yeah, I mean, seltzer was a very strong product in the last two summers. Now it's leveled off a little bit. And because innovation is so strong in the beer category and adjacent categories, we'll continue to have every year new products that will come and capture consumers' imagination. So consumer insights is a big thing in our business, trying to understand what consumers are looking for and providing them with those experiences. That's what makes ABI successful.
Hey, Brito, one thing we want to ask you, as we said, you know, 15 years as CEO of the company, from what I understand, from what Tim and I have been reading, is that you've got a lot of people calling you about your next act. You know, what are people calling you about? What kinds of offers? What might be your second act? Might it be running another beverage company?
You know, yeah, you're right. I mean, when I sat down on June 30th, you know, people called me even before that when it became public as I was stepping down, and with ideas, with, you know, things we could do together. And I said, hey, I don't have time now. I'll call you in July, August, September time frame. That's what I've been doing. And it's interesting because for the first time after 32 years in the same industry, an industry that was always exciting, changing, and consolidating and becoming global. So there was never a bored moment there, you know, there was never boredom. It was always very exciting. But now I've had the time and flexibility to really go deep in many different businesses. And I'm meeting very interesting people, learning about amazing business that I knew because I was reading the paper, but I didn't know much about them. I have the time to go deep. And I want to make a decision the next couple months. I have a couple of things that are now, you know, becoming more and more interesting in terms of ideas. But right now, I still haven't made a decision yet.
What industries are they in? And can you tell us who you've been talking to? Can you give us any hints?
I just got about 20 seconds here.
Well, my filter is very simple. I want to work with people that I admire, respect, with values that are the same as mine, in a place where I can have an impact. Those are the people I'm talking to.
All right. Looking forward to the news on that. And Carlos Brito, thank you so much. Brito, thanks for stopping by and joining us here. Carlos Brito, of course, former chief executive of AB InBev, joining us via Zoom. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week, and we are live at the Stanford Graduate School of Business having some great conversations with alumni, and we have an alumni in front of us right now. She's class of 2019. Valerie Shen is a partner and chief operating officer at G2 Venture Partners. So nice to have you here with us. And you spent 4 years here. 4 years here?
Two and a half. It was 4 years, but it was definitely a great
There's time to do your
years.
PhD if you want.
I actually think about that sometimes. My goal is actually to come back as a professor one day, so hopefully.
That's something we heard about earlier in our conversation with one of the professors. So tell us about your time here and how it really set you up for what you're doing now.
Yeah, so the most spectacular 2.5 years was spent here. I think what's really amazing about Stanford is you're constantly having great people paraded in front of you in the classroom, speaker series, your classmates, alum, and they've just done the most extraordinary things, and they're so transparent and honest about how they got to where they are today. And they almost always say, you know, I was just sitting there in your seat, I was actually skiing all the time. It makes you really feel like the people that are changing the world were just like us, and therefore there's no reason that we as students today can't be changing the world in the very near future. And I think that sort of just confidence that the GSB gives you is what carries a lot of us through the rest of our careers.
Well, I can't help but make the connection geographically where we are to the career that you're in now in venture capital. And I wonder to what extent you were exposed to venture capitalists being here in Silicon Valley during your time at Stanford.
I took a number of classes here thinking about entrepreneurship. I think what I learned a lot at Stanford was actually how entrepreneurs think. I didn't have that experience going in. I worked in venture capital, but almost all with people who came from banking or consulting, not from people who are on the ground. And then the classes at the GSB, you hear about what founders go through, actually how founders think about venture capitalists and the things that often venture capitalists do that founders don't like.
So the other side of the coin.
Exactly. That was a perspective that I don't think I would have gotten otherwise from my job.
Well, how do you carry that over then to what you are doing now as you make investments in entrepreneurs and companies?
I think that I just always think about my classmates who are going through the entrepreneurial journey themselves and hearing about their day-to-day struggles and thinking about how we can be sort of less annoying venture capitalists, whether that's just making sure that you're responding to the emails in a timely manner, understanding which portions of our term sheet we should be careful about, because some term that we're just throwing in there is actually going to cause a lot of heartache to the entrepreneur. Also just thinking about, you know, our reporting requirements and whether that's going to be a struggle and all the little things that we can be helping with, because the entrepreneurs are likely struggling with that.
When the companies that come to you for funding, or when you actually interact with these companies, when they do come to you, give us a characterization of them. Like, what excites you? What makes you want to say, yeah, that's something that we want to bet on. We want to bet our LPs money on.
Yeah. So the fund I work at, G2 Venture Partners, we invest in what we think of as the sustainable digitization of traditional industries. So in sort of...
Say what?
Yeah, exactly. Right.
I'm glad you said that, Carol, because I was like...
Yeah, it's a lot of words. Basically, we look at anything that's heavy asset, real economy based. So if there's something in that sector that you can drop on your foot and hurt yourself, that's something we do. Transportation, logistics, yeah. Energy, anything that we think can substantially impact the pathway of emissions and environmental sustainability moving forward. And what we want to invest in is businesses that can change those sectors in sustainable ways, and businesses that can get really big and that have customers that love them. So that doesn't necessarily mean we're trying to count, you know, like you're reducing this amount of carbon today and we're going to invest in the greatest carbon emissions. We're going to invest in something that works, that people love, that makes our lives better, and is also better for the environment. And as that grows bigger, our impact will get bigger as well.
Valerie, I have to say, I love talking with venture capitalists, whether it's early, angel, or moving it along, because I think you guys are seeing some of the stuff that's being thrown about that we are maybe going to be talking about as, you know, part of our everyday life in 5 years or 10 years. What would you say that might be as you look at some of the investments you're making or some of the investments that are put before you that might be something that nobody's really talking about, but we probably should be watching closely?
One space that we're really excited about now is digitizing warehouses and logistics. I think it's a movement that people were thinking about a bit before COVID, but now has really been accelerated.
Is it really not digital yet?
So there's certain problems that are very difficult. For example, if you think about an Amazon warehouse, there's still so many people working there and jobs that are often, you know, not that exciting, a little bit dangerous, a lot of probability that you're going to hurt yourself. And some specific problems, such as just getting a robotic arm to pick up an item,
right,
a specific small item, and put it in another specific bin, are surprisingly difficult, especially if you need 100% accuracy and you need to be doing it for all sorts of different shapes and objects. But as we can figure that out and then figure out scanning, figure out last mile transit, so all the goods and services that we're ordering can get to people's homes. And then, by the way, when we return them, we want to make sure those return items are actually sent somewhere where they can be used as opposed to just going directly to the landfill. So that whole logistics supply chain we think about a lot, and we think there's a ton of potential to reduce waste there.
Do you ever hear from founders in the area that there's concern that there's crowding out from some of the largest tech companies around? I mean, there's several trillion dollar tech companies that have the resources to develop a lot of this stuff from within or develop their own technology when they see a startup working on it.
You work for one of them, yeah. Google.
Yeah. I'm thinking about one that rhymes with Facebook.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. One is, it is true that the big technology companies are thinking about a lot of these problems, but they can't do it all, right? Just the number of different things we could be working on, there's space for a lot of the startups. And then I also think the big tech companies are a great exit for a lot of these founders. So there's multiple paths now. You can get fully to the point where you're going to IPO, or maybe Amazon wants to buy you, maybe Google wants to buy you. Lots of potential paths.
All right, gotta ask you, because we have done the stories at Bloomberg about women in Silicon Valley, and certainly in the venture space, not a lot of money going that way. Just got about 40 seconds left. What's been your experience so far as a woman working in venture capital that's still largely male dominated?
I've had a tremendous experience. I work with great people. I've never felt discriminated, never felt that there's been any sort of issue.
But it exists, right?
I haven't found that any discrimination exists. I think the problem is just how you think about your family, because do you want to, you know, go at it all the way, and do you want to have a stay-at-home spouse, or do you want to really make the dual income family work? I think that's the biggest struggle for men or for women, as opposed to any specific sort of discrimination against me as a woman.
All right. So great to catch up with you. Thank you so much. Good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
Can check back again, because we'd love to hear more about your portfolio.
Thanks.
We've been talking with Valerie Shen. She is Stanford Graduate School of Business, Class of 2019 partner, Chief Operating Officer at G2 Venture Partners. But it is truly one of my favorite conversations, just trying to get an idea of what are the new things coming down the road.
I mean, venture capitalists certainly understand, because they're the ones who are seeing this play out in real time.
Totally. All right. Let's get back to World of National News. Over to Nancy Lyon. She's in our D.C. studio. Nance, take it away.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
This is Bloomberg Business Week, and we are live at the Stanford Graduate School of Business having some great conversations with alumni, and we have an alumni in front of us right now. She's class of 2019. Valerie Shen is a partner and chief operating officer at G2 Venture Partners. So nice to have you here with us. And you spent 4 years here. 4 years here?
Two and a half. I wish it was 4 years, but it was definitely a great
There's time to do your
years.
PhD if you want.
I actually think about that sometimes. My goal is actually to come back as a professor one day, so hopefully.
That's something we heard about earlier in our conversation with one of the professors. So tell us about your time here and how it really set you up for what you're doing now.
Yeah, so the most spectacular 2.5 years was spent here. I think what's really amazing about Stanford is you're constantly having great people paraded in front of you in the classroom, speaker series, your classmates, alum, and they've just done the most extraordinary things, and they're so transparent and honest about how they got to where they are today. And they almost always say, you know, I was just sitting there in your seat, I was actually skiing all the time. It makes you really feel like the people that are changing the world were just like us, and therefore there's no reason that we as students today can't be changing the world in the very near future. And I think that sort of just confidence that the GSB gives you is what carries a lot of us through the rest of our careers.
Well, I can't help but make the connection geographically where we are to the career that you're in now in venture capital. And I wonder to what extent you were exposed to venture capitalists being here in Silicon Valley during your time at Stanford.
I took a number of classes here thinking about entrepreneurship. I think what I learned a lot at Stanford was actually how entrepreneurs think. I didn't have that experience going in. I worked in venture capital, but almost all with people who came from banking or consulting, not from people who are on the ground. And then the classes at the GSB, you hear about what founders go through, actually how founders think about venture capitalists and the things that often venture capitalists do that founders don't like.
So the other side of the coin.
Exactly. That was a perspective that I don't think I would have gotten otherwise from my job.
Well, how do you carry that over then to what you are doing now as you make investments in entrepreneurs and companies?
I think that I just always think about my classmates who are going through the entrepreneurial journey themselves and hearing about their day-to-day struggles and thinking about how we can be sort of less annoying venture capitalists, whether that's just making sure that you're responding to the emails in a timely manner, understanding which portions of our term sheet we should be careful about, because some term that we're just throwing in there is actually going to cause a lot of heartache to the entrepreneur. Also just thinking about, you know, our reporting requirements and whether that's going to be a struggle and all the little things that we can be helping with, because the entrepreneurs are likely struggling with that.
When the companies that come to you for funding, or when you actually interact with these companies, when they do come to you, give us a characterization of them. Like, what excites you? What makes you want to say, yeah, that's something that we want to bet on. We want to bet our LPs money on.
Yeah. So the fund I work at, G2 Venture Partners, we invest in what we think of as the sustainable digitization of traditional industries. So in sort of...
Say what?
Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad you said that, Carol, because I was like...
Yeah, it's a lot of words. Basically, we look at anything that's heavy asset, real economy based. So if there's something in that sector that you can drop on your foot and hurt yourself, that's something we do. Transportation, logistics, yeah. Energy, anything that we think can substantially impact the pathway of emissions and environmental sustainability moving forward. And what we want to invest in is businesses that can change those sectors in sustainable ways and businesses that can get really big and that have customers that love them. So that doesn't necessarily mean we're trying to count, you know, like you're reducing this amount of carbon today and we're going to invest in the greatest carbon emissions. We're going to invest in something that works, that people love, that makes our lives better and is also better for the environment. And as that grows bigger, our impact will get bigger as well.
Valerie, I have to say, I love talking with venture capitalists, whether it's early, angel, or moving it along, because I think you guys are seeing some of the stuff that's being thrown about that we are maybe going to be talking about as, you know, part of our everyday life in 5 years or 10 years. What would you say that might be as you look at some of the investments you're making or some of the investments that are put before you that might be something that nobody's really talking about, but we probably should be watching closely?
One space that we're really excited about now is digitizing warehouses and logistics. I think it's a movement that people were thinking about a bit before COVID, but now has really been accelerated.
Is it really not digital yet?
So there's certain problems that are very difficult. For example, if you think about an Amazon warehouse, there's still so many people working there and jobs that are often, you know, not that exciting, a little bit dangerous, a lot of probability that you're going to hurt yourself. And some specific problems, such as just getting a robotic arm to pick up an item,
right,
a specific small item, and put it in another specific bin, are surprisingly difficult, especially if you need 100% accuracy and you need to be doing it for all sorts of different shapes and objects. But as we can figure that out and then figure out scanning, figure out last mile transit, so all the goods and services that we're ordering can get to people's homes. And then, by the way, when we return them, we want to make sure those return items are actually sent somewhere where they can be used, as opposed to just going directly to the landfill. So that whole logistics supply chain we think about a lot, and we think there's a ton of potential to reduce waste there.
Do you ever hear from founders in the area that there's concern that there's crowding out from some of the largest tech companies around? I mean, there's several multi-trillion dollar, trillion dollar tech companies that have the resources to develop a lot of this stuff from within or develop their own technology when they see a startup working on it.
You worked for one of them, yeah. Google.
Yeah. I'm thinking about one that rhymes with Facebook.
Well, I think there's a couple of things there. One is, it is true that the big technology companies are thinking about a lot of these problems, but they can't do it all, right? Just the number of different things we could be working on, there's space for a lot of the startups. And then I also think the big tech companies are a great exit for a lot of these founders. So there's multiple paths now. You can get fully to the point where you're going to IPO, or maybe Amazon wants to buy you, maybe Google wants to buy you. Lots of potential paths.
All right, gotta ask you, because we have done the stories at Bloomberg about women in Silicon Valley, and certainly in the venture space, not a lot of money going that way. Just got about 40 seconds left. What's been your experience so far as a woman working in venture capital that's still largely male dominated?
I've had a tremendous experience. I work with great people. I've never felt discriminated, never felt that there's been any sort of issue.
But it exists, right?
I haven't found that any discrimination exists. I think the problem is just how you think about your family. Because do you want to, you know, go at it all the way? And do you want to have a stay-at-home spouse? Or do you want to really make the dual income family work? I think that's the biggest struggle for men or for women, as opposed to any specific sort of discrimination against me as a woman.
All right. So great to catch up with you. Thank you so much. Good luck with everything.
Thank you very much.
Can check back again, because we'd love to hear more about your portfolio.
Thanks.
We've been talking with Valerie Shen. She is Stanford Graduate School of Business, Class of 2019 partner, Chief Operating Officer at G2 Venture Partners. But it is truly one of my favorite conversations, just trying to get an idea of what are the new things coming down the road.
I mean, venture capitalists certainly understand, because they're the ones who are seeing this play out in real time.
Totally.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Carol Masser, Tim Stenovic, live at Stanford Graduate School of Business. I'm going to jump right into it, because we've got an amazing roundtable of students. And what's interesting is that one of the things that was part of the rankings this year was all about diversity. So let's get right to it, because this was important. Amar Garza is with us, MBA class of 2022, born in Mexico and lived in the U.S. since high school. Mario Del Cueto is also with us, born and raised right here in California. And Stephanie Grayson, a New Yorker. So welcome to Bloomberg. So nice to have you here with us. Stephanie, let me start with you. Your experience at Stanford, diversity was part of the rankings this year. We're talking about it a lot in the last year and a half because of the pandemic, because of George Floyd. How important is it to you in terms of your academic experience, but also as you move beyond academia into your professional life?
I really appreciate the question, because it's such an important topic, and it's one that deserves more discussion. It's paramount. It's actually a driver of why I came to pursue my MBA. As a Latina woman who is looking to build a career and lead an organization one day, I think it's essential that we learn not only how to lead organizations effectively, but how to lead and bring up others as well. It touches on a topic of championship, which is something that's a huge focus of the GSB. It's a huge personal focus. And I think that as co-presidents of HBSA, the Hispanic Business Student Association, it's something that we're really committed to furthering within our student community.
I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And Mario, I want to bring you in here. You're from California. You're a Californian here. So you didn't have to travel too far to get up here for your MBA. Give us an idea of what your experience has been like in the context of diversity at the school.
Yeah, I'd say my experience here has been very multifaceted, between social, academic, career. I think one of the things that I've held the most dear to me is my involvement with the HBSA. and the opportunity that the GSB has provided us to really lean into our identity, to celebrate vocally, here is who I am, here is who I'm coming from. And in doing so, hopefully inspire others to celebrate their identities. And so that experience has been probably the most fulfilling for me here.
All right, Omar, last but not certainly not least, we wanted to ask all of you the same questions first. I want to ask you about the conversations that we've all been having in the last year and a half. How is things like what happened to George Floyd, how is it the inequities that have been unveiled again because of the pandemic, how has it changed maybe some of the conversations you're maybe having with other students, non-Latinos and others on the campus?
Yeah, so I think it's very important to have open, honest discussions and conversations with people.
Were they not happening before?
They might have not been. I'm not exactly sure. Wasn't here. But that being said, I think it's important to be empathetic and really put yourselves in other people's shoes. And I think that's something that we've really been working hard to do. So whenever we have these conversations, it's all about empathy and really thinking about other people's perspective. So hopefully we can come to a better solution.
Yeah.
So Stephanie, how do you want to take what you've been doing here at GSB and take it out for when you go for your summer internship this summer and then ultimately when you graduate in 2022 and continue to pursue a career?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that something that just is pervasive throughout the GSB is a focus on impact. And I didn't realize how acute that would be until I got here and just am surrounded by this cohort of future leaders, current and future, to be honest, who are really committed to making the community and the world around us better. That has been critical in my experience, both from as someone who my past summer's internship at an impact investment firm, as well as an entrepreneur who I've been starting ventures during my time here at the GSB and really focusing on impact, whether it's in clean tech or upskilling. And I think that's an experience that I myself have had, but it's very pervasive across the broader community as well.
What matters most when the three of you go out looking for jobs or you're taking interviews and you're talking to recruiters? There's lots of things that right play into it. It can be the money, the company, the location, the experience, the diversity. Omar, let me ask you, what's gonna really, and I know it's gonna be a group of things, but is it gonna matter if the group, you're not gonna feel maybe comfortable that there aren't a diverse workforce?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and that's definitely an important factor that goes into it. However, I would say that at this moment in my life, and I think for a lot of us, impact we care about a lot. However, we also care about getting to the position in life where we're able to even have a larger impact.
Right.
So that being said, I think I'm looking a little bit more towards, okay, do I like this job? Do I see myself growing as a person, as a professional, and as a person in that role? And then being able to continue having an impact, maybe even at a more elevated level later down the road.
Hey, Mario, what goes through your head when you hear executives, when they are criticized for not having diverse boards, diverse executive ranks, when they say, you know, we're trying, but it's a pipeline problem?
Yeah, that's a tough question. I think ascribing it to a pipeline problem kind of abstracts from some of the good work that some of the CEOs are already doing and some that others could potentially do. When I think about pipeline, I think the one way that we can get to a more diverse executive level is to be exemplars of success and business involvement. And so I think as we take it down to the three of us, I am kind of empowered and motivated to be the best version of myself to hopefully get to that point of bringing in more diversity to the top.
Next time we're going to carve out 60 minutes to talk with you guys, so hopefully we can do it again. We gotta run. Omar Garza, Mario Del Cueto, and Stephanie Grayson. Good luck, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for the time.
Appreciate it.
You're listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week, and this is Bloomberg.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.